Stop the podcast.
Stop the podcast.
Hi, everybody. Just to let you know, this episode of Fish is sponsored by TV licensing.
Yes, TV licensing. What are you watching on TV, Andy?
I have been watching a show that's called 2 Weeks in August.
Okay.
Despite it being July at the time of recording.
Oh, you don't have to watch TV shows in the time that their name references.
No, absolutely. I watched The Darling Buds of May in winter. Anyway, 2 Weeks in August. It's a really good series. It's set on a lovely Mediterranean holiday.
Ooh.
And it's a group of old mates from uni who've gathered together. Some of them have got kids. Some of them haven't. Some of them have been going through big life events. And it's one of those amazing pressure cooker series where things just get more and more and more tense.
Oh, those stressful ones.
I love it. I love it.
I love my comedy, I gotta say. So I've been watching Android, which is Diane Morgan's new thing, and I absolutely love it. But I just, for me, I always, on television, watch everything with someone from Bolton in it. That's basically all I watch.
And she's from Bolton?
She's from Bolton.
But in this show, I believe she's a robot.
She's a robot, and it is not certain where in the country she's from.
It depends where the facility is that makes her, I suppose.
I guess so. But what are we actually here to say?
Oh, we're here to say that if you want to watch any of these shows, your TV license covers you to watch over 400 TV channels and everything on BBC iPlayer.
That is incredible.
So 2 Weeks in August has finished going out now, but you can get hold of it on the iPlayer.
If you want to find out more about this, then go to tvl.co.uk/pod.
Now back to the tension and the stress and the misery of this episode of Fish.
Oh, I thought you were referencing Bolton. On with the podcast.
What did you think of the Bucks' home season opener this week? Because our sports reporters weren't very impressed. We've got that and more coming your way in this week's Behind the Headlines podcast. I'm Katie O'Connell. Thanks for joining me again. Let's first head to news. Many of the medical tests we undergo are called wave tests. Essentially, the tests are so accurate and simple that Congress waived them from oversight. But what happens when those tests are administered incorrectly? Investigative journalist Ellen Gabler has a story running in Sunday's edition of the Journal Sentinel about the dangerous consequences of incorrectly administered wave tests. Here's reporter Brianne Chasseau's conversation with Ellen about her story.
Ellen, your story this week is about wave tests, which are tests we've likely all had, from being tested for strep throat to getting a glucose reading and more. What did you learn about them?
The tests are becoming increasingly common in our healthcare, and that's not necessarily a bad thing because they're quick, they're convenient, and they're inexpensive, but there are some serious quality problems with them.
What do you mean by quality problems?
Well, anybody can do the tests. So that's anybody from a nurse practitioner to a drugstore clerk. And that's one of the reasons they're becoming more popular, is because they don't really require any oversight from the government.
What is an example you found during your reporting of when these tests, if done incorrectly, can have serious implications?
The tests are supposed to be very simple and very accurate, but they can have serious consequences if they're done incorrectly. So, for example, there was a retiree who was taking painkillers for her back, and the clinic that was doing her drug testing messed it up. And so she tested positive for drugs that she hadn't been taking, and they pulled her off of her painkillers. There's another example. A baby incorrectly tested positive for influenza. And so that's what doctors were treating the child for. But in fact, the baby, something else was wrong with the baby, and the child ended up dying. Another test, an HIV test, a woman who was having a baby was given a waived HIV test, which she tested positive for. And so as a result, doctors gave her a cesarean section, and she wasn't allowed to breastfeed her baby when the baby was born. It turns out she didn't have HIV. So, again, these are tests that are supposed to be very simple and very accurate, but when they're not done correctly, which they aren't a lot of the time, there can be really serious repercussions.
Why hasn't anything been done about this?
This is an issue that regulators and lab industry trade groups have been concerned about for years, especially because the use of these tests is just exploding throughout the country. So it's something they've known about. They talk about it a lot, but they just haven't done anything really substantial to address it.
How did you stumble onto this, or not even stumble, how did you learn about this and begin reporting on it?
I've been reporting on issues with clinical laboratories for a couple months now, and this was something that a lot of my sources expressed a concern about. One of the things that was challenging in reporting this story was figuring out how to explain how big the problem is. So because this industry is not really regulated, it's hard to quantify the number of mistakes that occur. But there have been some government studies over the years, actually as far back as 1999. And since then, these studies have showed that the tests are frequently done incorrectly and serious harm to patients can happen because of it.
Did anything surprise you?
Probably the most surprising thing to me was that anybody is allowed to do these tests. You know, some 17-year-old or 18-year-old working at a drugstore. And also, it's incredibly easy to be able to do these tests. All you need to do is pay $150 every 2 years, and you're essentially certified to do the test. So that's pretty low barriers to entry. And, you know, again, that's why the tests are becoming so common. That's why, you know, places like CVS, Walgreens, doctor's offices, they want to do these tests because it's cheap and government regulators actually can't come in and inspect them.
What do you want readers to take away from this story?
I think it's important for people to know that tests aren't always accurate. It really depends on the quality of the people and the place doing your test. So if you get a result that doesn't seem right, make sure to ask questions.
As I said before, you can find this story in today's edition. For past stories from this investigation, plus videos and interactive graphics, visit jsonline.com/lab problems. Have you ever heard of a Kewpie doll? What about the Kewpie Diner in Racine? Wisconsin Trails editor Chelsea Lewis got a burger and a shake there earlier this week. Mary Louise Schumacher sat down with Chelsea to dig into the diner's history.
So, Chelsea, for this week's day out, you went to a really unusual place that, by my count, would appeal to people who love cheap hamburgers, doll connoisseurs, comic book lovers, and history buffs, right?
Yes.
So tell us, where did you go?
So I went to the Kewpie in Racine, and the Kewpie is this 90-year-old diner. It opened in Racine in the 1920s. The first Kewpie opened in Michigan in 1920, and there were, at its height, more than 300 across the country. Mm-hmm. And then kind of after World War II, they started to die out, and now there are only a handful. I think there are only five left in the country, and one of those is in Racine. So the Kewpie, you know, it's been around before McDonald's, before In-N-Out Burger, Five Guys, all of these kind of well-known fast food burger chains. The Kewpie has survived longer than that. So it's this really great little hometown diner. And like you said, dolls. So the Kewpie doll kind of has origins in comic books in the early 20th century. And when they opened the Kewpie, they kind of built on that. So they're these little angelic face dolls, you know, kind of the chubby face, smiling. And the Kewpie in Racine has this huge display case, like 16-foot display case of these dolls. But the real draw of the Kewpie are their cheap hamburgers, great shakes. Malted milk powder was invented in Racine, so it's really appropriate to get a milkshake when you're there. Mm-hmm. They also make homemade root beer. It's really, really good. So, yeah, it's kind of this nice, inexpensive hometown diner with kind of a cool history.
Can you tell us what it's like having a burger in a place where there are all of these little doll eyes looking at you? Is that a little weird?
Yeah, you know, I thought it would be a little creepy. Mm-hmm. But because it is kind of just this homey diner, you know, everyone from businessmen to older couples to high school students to construction workers kind of rubbing elbows at these counters. They have these two horseshoe-shaped counters. It just was maybe an added element of kitsch. It wasn't as, like, creepy as I thought it would be. Also, my back was to them when I was eating, so maybe that was part of it. But, no, I think it's just, like, a fun added element that the diner has.
And then there's a great little backstory in your piece, too, about the fact that this burger joint was knocked down and rebuilt exactly as is, or more or less, right?
Yeah.
So tell us a little about that.
Yeah. So I think in the 60s, they actually built a parking ramp right over the diner. So the diner was still there, but there was this hideous parking ramp over it. And then in the 90s, the city decided that the parking ramp was unsafe and they were going to have to tear it down. And unfortunately, the QP couldn't be saved. They said, you know, it's not safe for us to tear down the diner, to tear down the parking ramp and leave the diner. So they kind of exercised eminent domain. They bought the QP, tore it down. The owner at the time was like, I don't want the QP to die. So he ended up buying the land back from Racine. There's a funny little story about how Sam Johnson of S.C. Johnson kind of helped in that. He bought the land back, rebuilt the QP kind of in the same Art Deco look that it was first built, and it lives on.
Very cool. And you also make some other recommendations for things to do in Racine in your column as well. So tell us what else is on the list for Racine.
Yeah, so Racine has a terrific little downtown area along Main Street. There's a great art museum there, as I'm sure you know, Mary Louise, being our art critic. You know, there's a little waterfront area. What else do I list in there? Oh, yes, of course. Of course. I just mentioned S.C. Johnson, the S.C. Johnson headquarters with the Frank Lloyd Wright design buildings. And they just opened the tower last year that you can tour. Those tours are free. Mm-hmm. And actually this year, in honor of the Chicago
Architecture Biennial.
Yes, yes. They're leading free, or they're giving free shuttles down to Chicago from the headquarters there. So you can hop on a shuttle, go down to Chicago and see some of that as well.
Now, my mom had a QP doll growing up. And when I was a kid, I was terrified of it. But I have to admit, I'm a little bit curious about this diner. If you're equally curious, pick up today's paper or visit wisconsintrails.com. Let me give you a little bit of the backstory into today's business story. Ponzi schemes can start off as legitimate businesses or as complete hacks. Investors give an operator money to invest, but the Ponzi scheme operator doesn't pay them back based on profits. Instead, as our business reporter Carrie Spivak put it, you're taking the new money to pay old investors, and at some point, the music stops. For the past few weeks, Carrie has been reporting on a Ponzi scheme run by a man named Joseph Zeta. The scheme tricked investors like former Red Wings player Sergei Fedorov, as well as the CEO of Wisconsin-based Johnson Controls, Alex Molinaroli. Now, this isn't the first time Molinaroli has been caught up in controversy. Last year, he had his pay docked by $1 million when he failed to disclose an affair he was having with a consultant at Johnson Controls. Now he's entrenched in Zeta's Ponzi scheme. Molinaroli had invested in it after receiving a tip from his ex-wife's son. Molinaroli also funded Zeta's defense. And when Zeta's mansion in Michigan was foreclosed on, Molinaroli bought it and allowed Zeta to live in it rent-free.
So what does all of this mean for Johnson Controls and its employees?
The Molinaroli would say, and the board has said, it's a personal matter. It does not impact the company. The question that ethics experts that we've talked to and corporate governance people that we've talked to is, you have a CEO who's distracted. They're going through a major transformation of the company. He's distracted with this. It's embarrassing for him. It's embarrassing for the company. And because this is strike two, the outside experts we've talked to say the board should be concerned. They should be concerned, is there going to be another shoe to drop in this or in something else? But they say you should, the experts on the outside say you should be questioning his judgment. Molinaroli says it's separate, and the board has given their support to Molinaroli.
And the members of the board declined to be interviewed after releasing their statement supporting him, yes?
Right. One board member released the statement. And they're not making them available to talk at all.
What do you do then as a business reporter when you can't talk to the board about a story like this?
You still try to get to them. You keep putting in the requests. You call them individually. And you go to the outside and you go to sources, people who would know the board members. You talk to the academics and the experts on what would the board do. What do you think the board should do? And we did talk to Molinaroli, and, you know, you put in that request to talk to him. And, you know, he agreed to the interview. If he had not, we probably would have stopped over at his home and tried to find him there.
What was that interview like?
very testy from the get-go. He definitely did not sound like somebody who wanted to be interviewed. He kept saying I was putting words in his mouth and that type of thing. Very curt, very testy throughout the whole thing. But CEOs frequently are not used to being questioned. And, you know, good CEOs and bad CEOs, they're just not, that's something that generally doesn't happen to them every day in their lives.
What tipped you off about this story?
We got a tip for a person who pointed out that it came out in federal court in Florida from the prosecution that he was bankrolling the defense. A smaller paper in Florida mentioned that in the verdict story about Zeta, but just one line because, and I can't blame him, it's in Florida, it's not that big of a deal. And so then it was get a hold of the transcript, and we saw the prosecutor said a lot more than just that he bankrolled the defense. The prosecutor said he also offered to pay Zeta's restitution of up to $20 million, and she also said how he gave him the house.
So if you are one of our readers in Nakwang or Waukesha, why is this story significant to you?
I think, well, there's two things. Johnson Controls employs 3,400 people in the metro area. So you got the head of a very big employer who's a very prominent citizen in the community, very active in that type of thing. So you have that level of interest. And plus, it's just an interesting tale. I mean, if it happened in Salt Lake City, it'd be interesting. If it happened in Boston, it'd be interesting. Which is why Ponzi schemes... And I've noticed with a lot of white-collar crime stories that I write, I get a lot of reaction from people, a lot of feedback, just because they're interesting stories that these people are out there doing it. And you do have to be aware. You got to think twice before you invest, and you got to look into who you're investing with.
Carrie and Thomas Content have uncovered more about this case. If you're interested in finding out more about Molina Rowley's connection with Zeta, pick up their story in Sunday's edition of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, or visit jsonline.com/business. What awaits the newly appointed Speaker Paul Ryan? Our JS on Politics panel discussed the first House Speaker from Wisconsin and the challenges he faces after taking the gavel during this week's JS on Politics show.
So let's start with Craig. You were there in the Capitol this morning as Paul Ryan was sworn in. Very historic day for him, certainly in the state, as one of the highest person we've ever had in government. Talk a little bit about what the reaction was to now Speaker Ryan.
For a pretty divided and dysfunctional institution, it was kind of a happy and together day in the House chamber. I mean, partly because it is an historic occasion when there's a new speaker. There's only been 53 before Paul Ryan, but also, you know, he's well liked in the chamber by both Democrats and Republicans. There was a lot of genuine affection on both sides of the aisle. When he came up to the podium, he walked up along the Democratic side of the aisle and spent more time with Democrats than Republicans, you know, receiving hugs and handshakes. And his message was kind of open and uplifting when he talked about being open. Let's be open and honest about our disagreements, and let's make this place work again.
Yeah, so is that, I mean, that's the first day is always a happy day, but talk a little bit about some of the challenges he faces here, at least in the short term. The budget issue was cleared up a little bit yesterday, but what are the main challenges for Speaker Ryan right now?
Well, I mean, he is torn between factions in his caucus that disagree about how to advance their agenda. I mean, some of them are very militant and some of them are more pragmatic. This is what was John Boehner's undoing. Now, Paul Ryan, you know, starts out, I think, in a better place because he's got a lot of goodwill on the right. I mean, some people don't think he's conservative enough, but he is the most conservative speaker we've had in our lifetimes. So that counts for something with his caucus. And he's also, he knows how to legislate. He knows how to fundraise. He knows how to do a lot of the functions of a speaker, even though he's never been in leadership before. So he starts out with some pluses, but some people, you know, would argue that this is just a job that's almost undoable in this time and place, that the institution is so polarized and Republicans are so divided that for some Republicans, any accommodation with Democrats, even just to keep the lights on in government, is a capitulation. And the more people that feel that way, the more trouble Paul Ryan's going to have with his own caucus.
Right, let me ask Dan and Mary. So we've well met and interviewed and talked with Paul Ryan and watched him over the years. With his persona and his personality, is this job a good fit for him, do you think? Or would he truly rather be in the nuts and bolts of the policy on the Ways and Means Committee?
It's a good fit, I think, for the Republicans. It's not a great fit for him. He's a policy wonk. He enjoys doing numbers, and you know, he likes doing his presentations, his PowerPoints, and talking about ideas and so forth. And that's why I think he had so much resistance. And as Craig said, he is very conservative, but at the same time, I've been interested in how right-wing media has already begun attacking him and raising questions about whether he's conservative enough on immigration and other issues.
Yeah, what do you think, Mary? Is this the right job, the right person at the right time, but is it the right job for Paul Ryan?
I don't know that the speaker is the right job for anybody. It seems like you're kind of going to be taking fire from all sides. I mean, I think if he can unite the caucus and be an effective speaker, there's been a lot of speculation about him as a presidential candidate. I think if he is a successful speaker, that would boost his chances. However, if he comes under attack from the right, comes under attack from the left, ends up getting ousted, that's not going to help his future.
And he's not going to totally unite them. Even today, there were 9 votes for Webster,
right.
People who were not satisfied with him. He's got, you know, a couple dozen hardcore Republicans that he's going to have to deal with, the same people that John Boehner had problems dealing with. And even though he's a much more likable character, and it seems like a genuinely nice guy for anyone who deals with him, there are going to be ideological struggles.
Other segments in this week's show include a discussion about the winners and losers in this week's GOP debate, as well as a segment about Ron Johnson and Russ Feingold and their various scores on our PolitiFact Truthometer. You can find that conversation online at jsonline.com/politics. You can also download it as a podcast from iTunes or Stitcher Radio. As I said before, the Milwaukee Bucks had their home opener this week, but the crowd may have put in more effort than the team. Here's Matt Velasquez and Bucks writer Charles Gardner with more.
If you missed the Bucks season opener on Wednesday night, well, that might actually have been a good move on your part, because the Bucks celebrated their first home season opener since 1984 by getting blown out 122-97 by the New York Knicks. And Charles, that was not what was expected heading into the season, you know, for either team, with the Bucks coming in with high hopes and the Knicks coming off a pretty terrible season last year. You know, but obviously, you know, first night brings a new season, brings new teams. Hope springs eternal for everybody. And what were some of your takeaways from last night's game?
Well, you're right, Matt. It was a bit of a stunner, I think, because of the expectations for the Bucks. But as we've been talking about during the preseason, they are working in new players. And this is going to take some time, as we've seen. And we saw it on display last night. And of course, the Bucks were missing a couple of key players, Giannis Antetokounmpo and Jabari Parker, still out while he's getting ready to soon, the Bucks hope, make that comeback from his knee injury. I think one of my takeaways was the Knicks are much better. I mean, their bench scored 73 points. And even though the Bucks played very poorly on defense, the Knicks last year couldn't have scored 73 points off their bench if they were playing the local Y team.
No.
I mean, they could not have. So here you had Derek Williams, 24 points, Langston Galloway, former D-League star, 16, Lance Thomas, Jerian Grant from the former Notre Dame player, and Kyle O'Quinn, who's a good backup center, a good pro. I was talking with Marcus Johnson at practice today, and he said, you know, look at those guys on the bench. They really came out and did the job. We all know Derek Williams was number 2 pick. It's been a disappointment, but was in Sacramento the last 2 years. But he looks like a perfect fit on that Knicks bench. And even Jason Kidd said last night, hey, if you had told him they were going to hold Carmelo Anthony to 11 points, he'd say, well, you know, we would win the game. But it wasn't the case. The rookie certainly looked very good, too, Kristaps Porzingis. For a 7'3" man, you and I talked, Matt, last night at the game, this kid can really move. he moves his feet. He forced several turnovers. He had a nice double team on MCW that caused a turnover. He even hit a three-pointer. So you have to give the Knicks some credit too. Now, on the other hand, the takeaway on the Bucks side was, as MCW said after the game, they were disorganized defensively. Kid questioned their effort. And again, today after practice, he said, you know, we have to have much better effort than that. So you can't overreact to one game, especially a season opener. If you look back, the Bucks blew a big lead in Charlotte last year and lost the opener in overtime. But I will say, in that game, they were very competitive, and they weren't too competitive last night.
And if you're interested in hearing more about the Bucks, visit jsonline.com/Bucks. We're going to end our show with a little something different this week. Starting on Wednesday, our newsroom is diving into a story about a 40-year-old cold case from Franklin. We're going to let you hear the first few minutes of the podcast from that show.
I'm Gina Barton. I'm the criminal justice investigative reporter here at the Journal Sentinel. So for the past several years, really, and more intensely for the past several months, I've been investigating the cold case homicide of John Zara, who was 14 years old when he was murdered in 1976.
John Zara has lunch with some friends in the Franklin High School cafeteria. Then, without telling anyone his intentions, he disappears. The boy will be missing for 8 days. Police, family, neighbors search and find nothing. A reward is offered. The search widens and becomes increasingly frantic, but nothing is found. Then the unlikely. Two boys taking a shortcut through Whitnall Park find John Zara, nude, face down in the rocks and mud. Police will say he's been molested and then bludgeoned, perhaps with a large rock.
Almost 4 decades later, John's murder still hasn't been solved. His family keeps hoping that maybe advances in technology, someone with a guilty conscience, someday that they'll get an explanation for what happened. And with this series, we're hoping to shed some light on the investigation.
I've been working on this podcast with Gina Barton. The story is moving and frustrating and important. Again, it comes out on Wednesday, and it will run every Wednesday after that for the next 7 weeks. We hope you'll tune into that podcast and read that story as well. And with that, I'll sign off for this week. Thanks again for listening, and we'll be back next week with more.
Stop the podcast!
Stop the podcast!
Hi, everybody. Just to let you know, this episode of Fish is sponsored by TV licensing.
Yes, TV licensing. What are you watching on TV, Andy?
I have been watching a show that's called 2 Weeks in August.
Okay.
Despite it being July at the time of recording.
Oh, you don't have to watch TV shows in the time that their name references.
No, absolutely. I watched The Darling Buds of May in winter. Anyway, 2 Weeks in August. It's a really good series. It's set on a lovely Mediterranean holiday.
Ooh.
And it's a group of old mates from uni who've gathered together. Some of them have got kids. Some of them haven't. Some of them have been going through big life events. And it's one of those amazing pressure cooker series where things just get more and more and more tense.
Oh, those stressful ones.
Yeah, I love it. I love it.
I love my comedy, I gotta say. So I've been watching Android, which is Diane Morgan's new thing, and I absolutely love it. But I always on television watch everything with someone from Bolton in it. That's basically all I watch.
And she's from Bolton.
She's from Bolton.
But in this show, I believe she's a robot.
She's a robot, and it is not certain where in the country she's from.
It depends where the facility is that makes her, I suppose.
I guess so. But what are we actually here to say?
Oh, we're here to say that if you want to watch any of these shows, your TV license covers you to watch over 400 TV channels and everything on BBC iPlayer.
That is incredible.
So 2 Weeks in August has finished going out now, but you can get hold of it on the iPlayer.
If you want to find out more about this, then go to tvl.co.uk/pod.
Now back to the tension and the stress and the misery of this episode of Fish.
Oh, I thought you were referencing Bolton. On with the podcast.